Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio.
You are listening to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, or the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine men of the Americas, the holy people of Africa, or the present-day Ottawahis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times. From the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Levant, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tohiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Anuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Hello, everybody. This is your old friend Bluewater coming to you from the tops of the Rocky Mountains. And before we introduce this evening's guest, I'd like to recognize Bunny Singswolf, who sang that song you just heard, and Karen Lake, the author. Actually, they authored it together, and Bunny sang it. I would also put in a prayer request for our friend, Jay Lone Wolf Morales. Needs your prayers. Tonight's guest on Prophecy Keepers is Magin Ben Yosef. He's an American-born, Orthodox Jewish educated, but did not convert to Judaism. He has been a leading spokesman for the House of Joseph movement and wants to explain to everybody tonight. We'll go to about 15 more minutes, and then we'll take callers. But he would like to explain to everybody tonight how the foreign policy of the United States and Israel may, according to prophecy, end in disaster for both countries or any other country that's involved. How are you this evening, Ben Yosef?
Aho, Bluewater. Great to hear from you.
Oh, good to hear from you, too. First of all, why don't you explain to the folks what a Magid is?
Okay. I was given a choice of any smicha, that's like an ordination that I wanted, except rabbi, since I'm not Jewish. And they didn't want to set a precedent in Israel of having a non-Jewish rabbi. So I was given a choice in several things, and I chose Magid because a Magid is a storyteller, and that is in keeping with my Native American side.
So how'd you get this gig? I mean, what, long story made short, how did you end up doing, you know, 2 7-year stints in Israel and tell a little bit the folks a little bit about the politics and everything you went through to try to get the House of Joseph recognized. Go ahead.
Well, Bluewater, I was a daily newspaper editor. That was my former career of about 20 years, and I had a very strange experience with a light which shone on my face, and it was a very bright light, and it scared the bejesus out of me and a number of people in my in the newspaper office. Anyway, to make a long story short, I wound up leaving the newspaper business, went to a Christian seminary where I learned Hebrew, and then from that point moved to Israel, rejoined the media to support myself as a missionary in an all-Muslim West Bank village called Bethphage. And I lived there among the Palestinians for some time, and then eventually moved into Jerusalem proper and studied with rabbis while I was working at the Jerusalem Post as a religion writer and editor, and wrote a column. And I got involved in the politics of Israel through this column, which was opposed to a Palestinian state in Judea Samaria. Let me qualify that we're not opposed to a Palestinian state in another part of the land of Israel, but Judea Samaria is not the place that it should be, because Judea Samaria is set aside, according to biblical prophecy, as an area to reconcile the children of Joseph and the children of Judah. These comprised separate kingdoms. They were exiled 136 years apart, and they never reconciled after a civil war and the northern kingdom aligning with the enemies of the southern kingdom. So I got involved in the politics there. My last stay in Israel was in 2000 and 2001, and because I was opposed to this Palestinian state, I was arrested on three occasions and imprisoned without any charges ever being filed against me. I eventually was released and was told that I had to take a voluntary vacation from the state of Israel. And that's where I'm at, where I am now, in exile, here, living here in the southwest Colorado Rockies, and have aligned myself with the descendants of Geronimo's Apaches. And that's quite a story to tell. But I'll let you take the lead on.
Well, why don't you? Well, first of all, to bring to everybody to remembrance, you know, if you ever went to Sunday school, or if you saw in the movie Joseph, you might remember 12 brothers, all descendants of Jacob, who was renamed Israel, and Joseph was the one that was very gifted and perhaps the most gifted of all of the brothers, and they became jealous. And if the coat of many colors story, this is the guy, folks. And now this man became second only to Pharaoh in Egypt. And now I guess according to the prophecy, these descendants that walked away from the land of Israel about 2,730 years ago, they have a promise that they can once again take possession of their inheritances, which are up in the mountains of Judea and Samaria, but it's on the wrong side of the green line, and I never really did understand why they wanted a non-contiguous Palestinian state when, I mean, the Palestinians have already got Gaza. I mean, that's no problem, and they could extend the homeland up the coast, but I mean, why do the Palestinians even want that land over in the mountains? I don't, well, water probably. But anyway, but there's a very, very dire prophecy in Obadiah. Why don't you tell the folks about that and what the Bible says will happen if these Palestinians are in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Okay. Well, let me say, first of all, that the children of Joseph do not inherit all of Judea Samaria, only the northern two-thirds of Judea Samaria, which is the land called the Shomron or Samaria. And it was named Samaria because whenever the northern tribes were vacated from this region, Samaritans were brought in by the Assyrian conquerors. And so the name Judea Samaria refers to the fate of Judah and the fate of Joseph, because it is Joseph's land. But Blue Otter, not only is it Joseph's land, it is also the birthright of Jacob. And, you know, the thing that we need to emphasize as far as the fate of the Palestinians who live in the territories of Joseph is that the prophet Obadiah referred to these people as the House of Esau because perhaps of their Palestinian ultra-nationalism, their perpetual hatred of the children of Jacob. For whatever reason, the little book of Obadiah, the smallest book in the Bible, tells the story of the fate of the House of Esau who remain in the territories of Joseph. And unfortunately, our roadmap to peace in the Middle East, proposed by the Bush administration, proposes to give the birthright of Jacob to the House of Esau. You can't ask for a worse curse.
Okay, now just to remind folks, these are the two, you remember there was Jacob, there was Esau, and Esau sold his birthright for a mess of pottage. So, I never really did understand why they were trying to force a non-contiguous Palestinian state unless they really wanted to see all these people killed and to fulfill the prophecy negatively. What do you think about that?
Well, the problem we run into is the fact that whenever Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau, was pregnant with these twins, there was a battle going on inside of her womb. That's exactly how it's described in the biblical account. And she went to a prophet, and the prophet told her, in your belly are two nations. And he used the word two le'um. A le'um is a people who unite around the same ideology. But these are two different le'um, which were in the womb of Rebekah. And so this means that from birth, the children of Jacob and the children of Esau were to be kept apart. And unfortunately, our politicians in Washington do not understand this idea of separate le'umim. And therefore, they are proposing this non-contiguous state that would comprise Judea, Samaria, and the Gaza. Whereas the biblical Palestinian state, which, by the way, Blue Otter, if people are interested in looking at this in more detail, on my website, at www.torah-voice.org is the biblical Palestinian state, which I call the Zechariah Plan, because the prophet Zechariah alluded to this in chapter 9. And the biblical Palestinian state comprises the existing region of the Gaza, extended to Ashkelon, Ashdod, and ancient Ekron, and the very, very fertile Shephelah Valley, which would make it a contiguous state and would give the Palestinian people an area that is much, much more fertile than the land in which they're living now. As a matter of fact, the borders of Israel today are called the Green Line, because beyond that Green Line in Judea Samaria, the Palestinians have not been able to get very much to grow. And so the fertile Shephelah Valley, together with the Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Ekron, would give them enough territory and a very good livelihood. And, of course, some arrangement would have to be worked out where they could still share Jerusalem. But, these are things that have to be worked out. Unfortunately, our State Department is not even thinking along these lines. And they're not realizing the curse that they're bringing on this nation. And we can see the evidence of it already. It's all around us with the mortgages and the grocery prices, the gasoline prices, the weather. It's obvious that the Creator is not very pleased about something.
Yeah, and I want to remind folks, because of his Orthodox Shemitah, Ben Yosef is qualified and allowed to teach Torah to non-Jews. So if you have a soft spot in your heart for Israel, maybe not necessarily the Zionist government that's running it into the ground, but the real Israel, and please, Ben Yosef needs your support. Go to torah-voice.org, make a donation. Ben Yosef's living by faith, folks. He's doing this without purse or script. It is a little scary, and I'm not far behind him, but he needs your support, folks. So where now? And I also want to add that Ben Yosef is a scholar, and he had the support. Well, why don't you tell the folks about the support from the prominent Orthodox rabbis there, and what their stature was in Israel.
Okay. Well, let me say first of all that I've had very little contact from Israel since I've been in exile. But I do have a number of people that I stay in touch with via email. They keep me up to date on what's going on. But my smicha came from the Ribi Shani Dor, the Breslav Hasid Rav Yisrael Z. Yehuda Schneider, who was chosen to be one of the members of the revived Sanhedrin court in Jerusalem. He was a good friend of mine. We've known each other now for 17 years. And he was my mentor when I was in Israel. And whenever he was named, well, just before he was named to the Sanhedrin court, actually, he's the one who arranged with some other rabbis there that I should have some kind of authority to do what I'm doing, and so they gave me the smicha to which you refer.
So, now you had a lot of adventures over there. We don't have time to go into a lot of it. We're going to be going to a break here. I got about a couple more minutes. Why don't you tell the folks in the couple of minutes that we've got about the timeline and why this year is so important?
Okay, the year 2008 figures in the prophecy of the return of the house of Joseph specifically, because whenever the prophet Ezekiel was told to issue a decree of exile against both the house of Judah and the house of Israel, the southern tribes and the northern tribes, Ezekiel lay on his side for 390 days for a judgment against the northern tribes. And God decreed that every day that he lay on his side would be 1 year of judgment against the northern tribes. Well, the northern tribes never repented from their sins, their transgressions. And so that judgment, according to the Torah, was multiplied sevenfold to 2,730 years. And if that 2,730 years is reckoned to begin at the time of the exile in 722 before the Common Era, you do the math, subtract 722 from 2,730, and you come up with the year 2008. So 2008 is the year that the decree of judgment against the northern tribes of Israel ends. Now, what happens after that is the question, whether the children of Joseph should now focus on reuniting among themselves, which is what I think is supposed to happen. There's two branches of the family of Joseph. There's Menashe and there's Ephraim. And Menashe, as hopefully we'll get into a little later, figures very prominently in the prophecies of the Native Americans, and especially the Hopi migration.
Well, we've got about 10 seconds for the first break. Folks, Prophecy Keepers, we're about a lot of things, but we're about helping you prepare. So take a listen to this break. Well, we're back, and if that break didn't shock you a little bit, I would be surprised. anyway, to continue what we were talking about before the break, you mentioned Hopi prophecy during the break. Well, maybe now is a good time to introduce this to folks and how Hopi prophecy ties in with the House of Joseph.
Okay. Well, we really have two written documents that tie the Hopi prophecies to the House of Joseph. Now, as a Magid, one of my duties is that of Mokia, which means I'm like an exegete. And an exegete should focus his attention on written evidence more than anything else. And so the two documents that I've been examining, one of them is the Book of Hopi, which was written in 1976 by Dr. Frank Waters, after Waters had lived among the Hopi and was given permission to write about their ceremonies. And he discovered that the Hopi had a tradition that seven of their cities or clans buried their weapons of war and declared a vow of peace. And this is how they became known as Hopi, because the name Hopi, according to a medicine man, Emory Holmes, at Hotavia, up on the Third Mesa, according to him, the name Hopi means peace. So it seems evident that they were called something else before they were called Hopi. Now, here we turn to the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon correlates with these Hopi prophecies. It was published 146 years before the Hopi traditions were even made public. And in the book known as Alma, chapter 23, verses 7 through 13, we find that the Lamanites are described as occupying seven cities in approximately the same region as the Hopi, here in the southwest of America. And these seven cities also declared a vow of peace and laid down their weapons of war. It seems that this is just too much of a coincidence for it not to be tied somehow to the Hopi prophecies. The Mormon records that these Lamanites were no longer called Lamanites after this happened. Rather, they were called Anti-Nephi-Lehi. Now, Anti-Nephi-Lehi, to me, is not a name that's going to catch on. And so it seems logical that at some point this name would be changed to reflect the peaceable nature of these people, the Hopi. We also have a prophecy in the Book of Mormon, which I believe ties very directly to the Hopi migration. Laman, who was the eldest son of his father, Lehi ben Menashe ben Yosef. Now, Lehi ben Menashe ben Yosef was a prophet from Jerusalem. He was descended from Joseph, however. But he and his family remained in Jerusalem after the exile of the northern tribes. Therefore, they remained in covenant with the Creator. They possibly were part of the family of Judah at that time because they were living in Jerusalem, yet they're descended from Joseph. Anyway, Laman had been a big disappointment to his father. And Lehi had to flee with his family from Jerusalem after prophesying the destruction of the Jerusalem temple 14 years before it occurred. And they fled to the south, and they came to a riverbed that adjoined with the Red Sea. And Lehi observed the rising and falling of the tide of the Red Sea and how it would fill and empty this riverbed. And so he turned and he pointed to his son, Laman, the one he'd been disappointed with. And he said, "That you might be like unto this river, continually returning to the fountain of all righteousness." And that's in 1 Nephi chapter 2 and verse 9 in the Book of Mormon. Now the Hopi were told by their ruling spirit, whose name was Mossaw, essentially the same thing that Abraham was told. They're told to walk the length and the breadth of the land in all four directions and stake it out everywhere they migrate, so that in the future the entire land that had been staked out would belong to the descendants of the Hopi. They were told to make these migrations to the glaciers as far south as they could travel and to the eastern and western oceans, but each time they were to return to the area from which they had left. Now, this sounds a lot like the prophecy that was spoken to Laman. And the sacred area, known today as the Four Corners of southwest Colorado, southeast Utah, northwest New Mexico, and northeast Arizona, in ancient times was known by another name. According to the medicine man Emory Holmes, again at Hotavia on Third Mesa, the Aztec were one of the clans of the Hopi who arrived rather late into Central and South America. And he says that the Aztec are the ones who coined the name Aztlan, which means homeland. While they didn't return, they were supposed to, they told their children to be mindful someday of their homeland, Aztlan, in the north. And here at the eastern gate, the eastern region of this Four Corners area, We've started an organization called Iglesia de Aztlán, the Assembling of Aztlán. Actually, it was chartered back in 1992, long before this name could have been associated with anything to do with the elements who are coming up from the south and are causing problems with committing crimes. There is a dimension to this name Aztlán which has perverted it. But here at the eastern proximity of this area, we're attempting to set up and prepare for Native American elders to come here at the eastern gate of this region. Traditionally, that's where elders came. We don't know what they'll do when they get here, but we anticipate that it has something to do with preparing for the aftermath of the Hopi purification.
Exactly. And would you like to take calls now from people that feel a kindred spirit?
I'd be delighted, Blue Otter.
Well, the call-in number is toll-free 877-876-5227 in the USA only. And USA and Canada, you can call 888-815-9756. So it's 877-876-5227 in the USA. Our USA Canada line 888-815-9756, and we'll invite anybody that'd like to call in and discuss this. And I understand now when you're working with I heard you did another interview over on another BBS station, and of course everybody knows about President Bush. Are they aware that a whole bunch of Orthodox rabbis declared him to be Gog Magog?
Well, this is one of the things that we do have on our website. It is an exegesis of the passages in Ezekiel that pertain to the infamous leader known as Gog Magog, whose objective is to steal Israel oil. Now, what I find interesting about it is if anyone will look on my website at www.torah-voice.org, there's a logo there in the right-hand corner, which is a picture of an outline of Judea Samaria that is an outline of a man wearing a crown. And the prophecies about Joseph were that the blessings of the deep, which today we would refer to as oil, but the blessings of the deep would be on the crown of the head of Joseph. And if you look at that logo, the crown, right at the top of the crown, is a little village called Megiddo, which is, of course, the site of the future Battle of Armageddon. And it appears that what is going on in the territories of Joseph is that the Saudis, who influenced the Bush administration to propose this suicidal plan for Israel, are attempting to steal the oil of Israel with the help of George W. Bush, who the Jerusalem Sanhedrin court recently gave a scroll declaring him to be the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. And if you read in Ezekiel chapter 38 and chapter 39, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal is this infamous Gog. There are some interesting things about that name, Gog. First of all, in Hebrew, the name George would be spelled exactly like Gog, because in Hebrew, the tendency of the resh, the R sound, to assimilate is quite common, especially with the name George, because George is a name that is difficult for a native Hebrew speaker to pronounce. Rather, George is called Joj, J-O-J, Joj. And if you transliterate J-O-J into Hebrew, since there is no J sound in Hebrew, you have to use the G. And therefore, George W. Bush is Gog W. Bush. And whenever you take the gematria, now gematria is a means of assigning a numerical value to every letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The first 10 letters have the value of 1 through 10. The next 10 letters have the value of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, and so on up to 100. And the last three letters, 200, 300, and 400. If you take the gematria of the name George Walker Bush, it is 666.
Well, isn't that interesting? And this is the guy that's, you know, sitting with his finger on the button in Washington, D.C., and it makes me wonder what is going to happen next, you know, if the House of Representatives and the Senate and the legislators of the United States, if they can't figure out how to save the economy, there are executive orders that have been enforced for quite a while that would enable President Bush to declare different levels of martial law, like the martial law that worse than we've got, because basically, you know, we're not under any kind of constitutional law. And yes, folks, I am a Ron Paul supporter. I support the great law of peace of the Haudenosaunee, and they got the United States, according to Ben Franklin, modeled their law after the great law of peace. And there is only one person in Washington, D.C. that's for the Constitution. That's Ron Paul. And, you know, here's a guy, folks, that, I mean, his name wasn't allowed to be mentioned at the Republican convention. Any delegate that showed up with pro-Ron Paul materials had him taken, confiscated, literally. If anybody tried to take the stand and mention his name, their microphone was shut off. So there's your guy, folks. You know, if you think either the other two candidates are going to change anything, and Ben Yost, you understand you had a spiritual experience here recently on this subject. You want to tell folks about it? About not being fooled.
Oh yeah, yes. I was listening. I was staying up late writing, and I was listening to a broadcast of Coast to Coast AM. And George Norrie, who narrates that, does musical interludes between the news. And the musical interlude was from The Who, the song Don't Get Fooled Again. And there's a line in that song that goes something like, "We better get on our knees and pray," and then there's a pause, "We don't get fooled again." Well, I had been praying specifically about the Palin, the vice president, and you know, that was what was in my spirit, was to pray that we didn't get fooled again. And then a couple of days later, I went to the Purification Lodge here, the Apache Purification Lodge, and I think it was during the Spirit Round, the second round of the lodge, that Ken Rivers prayed the exact same words about the presidential election. "Grandfather, help us not to be fooled again." And then I got a third sounding with the same words. And so I felt like it was very important that before any Native American decides in this election, that we should determine exactly where these candidates stand on a few key issues. And from my perspective, they relate to spiritual issues, because I personally believe that. And let me ask, does anybody else on the face of Turtle Island think that we're under a curse? Because I think the evidence points that we are. And so, anyway, I believe before we would support Palin or Obama or any of the candidates, that we should know exactly what their position is on this suicidal roadmap to peace in the Middle East and a Palestinian state somewhere other than Judea Samaria.
Folks, we're back from the break and putting a good scare into you. You know, we're not trying to scare people. We're trying to convince them it's time to do something. And, of course, at Prophecy Keepers, we teach, you know, how to get in touch with the Creator. And but this is what we do full-time, folks. Neither Ben Yosef and I have any other means of support. And in order for this show to continue weekly, and we would like to get on more often. There's a lot of things that we could do, and But anyway, be sure and offer Benyos if your support. Well, before we went on break, you were talking about the political situation and how it's important not to be fooled. I understand there were some and the rumor mill said that there's some interesting things going on in our military, and I heard one rumor that a DEFCON 1 order was given, which would, under certain circumstances, would release our military commanders to engage anyone that might be engaging our fleet. So what do you think, you know, going on in the Straits of Hormuz and with Israel? You know, a lot of people are kind of concerned right now. And what do you think about the military situation, Ben Yosef?
Well, this is really not an area of my expertise, but I would say one thing, that when a nation is under burst, it could extend to all aspects of American experience, including the military. I personally believe our involvement in Iraq is related to this same curse, because during the administration of H.W. Bush, because George H.W. Bush also has an association with the name GOG, which we may talk about in a few weeks. We're trying to line up some more information about the actual source of this curse that has come upon the United States. But there's a scripture, Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3, which spells out a spiritual principle. It's God speaking to Abraham, and he says to him, Abraham, I will bless those who bless you, but those who curse you, a curse will come upon them. They will cause themselves to be cursed, in other words. So when George H.W. Bush convinced the our allies and the Arab nations not to align with Saddam Hussein in the 1991 Persian Gulf War, immediately after the ceasefire of that war, within a few days, Secretary of State James Baker came to Jerusalem with a suitcase. And in that suitcase, he had several demands. And one of these demands was that Israel must no longer build settlements in Judea, Samaria. And the settlements that were there should be dismantled. Apparently, this was a deal that had been struck between the George H.W. Bush administration, Secretary of State James Baker, and Palestinians who lobby Washington in order to get a Palestinian state. And that's when the pressure began for the Palestinian state, was at the close of this war. I personally believe because the United States chose Iraq, a land that has long been condemned in the Bible.
Also known as Babylon.
Also known as Babylon. But a land that's long been condemned over the territories of Joseph and preparing the territories of Joseph for the return of the children of Joseph, that this is why, spiritually, we're in Iraq today.
Very interesting. Yeah, and you know, you know, the Bushes don't just have their thumb in the eye of Israel. They got their thumb in the eye of the Apache Nation. So we want to tell them, remind the folks about the skull of Geronimo.
Okay, I don't know how much we want to talk about that right now, Blue Otter, because
or we can talk about whatever you like. We've got about 11 more minutes left.
Okay, I'd like to get Jimmy Ten Rivers to talk to you about that. And,
oh, is he there with you?
No, he's not. He's,
oh, okay. We'll do another interview.
Yeah. But I'll say this much. Yes, it's true that Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the president, was the individual who led the raiding party at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and dug up the skull of Geronimo and took it to Yale University and established the Skull and Bone Society. They also took the skulls of some other young Apaches. We believe the skull of Mangus Coloradus, who was also a revered Apache leader, who was killed by the army in Mexico, and his head has never been found. Anyway, this
And Mangus was a Membrano.
Right, he was a Membrano. And the Apache here, the descendants of the people of Geronimo, are uniting under the Membrano. And let me just put in a real quick plug for what we're doing here again. I am a member of the board of directors of Iglesia de Atlan. I'm a spiritual elder among the Apache, and I'm a member of the board of directors of Turtle Tribe, and therefore I have been permitted to share this vision of Atlan. But there's a band of about 60 families of Apache, and we're joined by growing numbers of Chicano. And we have been told by the Spirit, and this has been confirmed time and time again, to prepare for the arrival of Native American elders. Now, this is in keeping with many Native prophecies for the last time, but the one that is most specific that comes to my mind is from the Oglala Sioux, that a place should be prepared in the mountains for the time just before great fires sweep the plains, where elders will come to plan how to steward and heal the land after the purification. And we believe place is somewhere in proximity of the eastern gate of this sacred Four Corners region, Atlan. And again, this is the gate where traditionally elders assemble.
And you know, when I first met, of course, I've known you probably since about 2000, year 2000, and on and off, you know, either been reading your reports that came out of Israel or, you know, we started corresponding and, you know, picking up a friendship 2-3 years ago. But anyway, just met Jimmy Tenrivers this last January, and when I heard that prophecy, I went, oh, my gosh, because back somewhere in the summer of 2006, Creator talks to me every once in a while, and you know, there's details at prophecykeepers.com, but he told me something really, really far-fetched. And it was to warm me up and get me ready for what he told Jimmy. What he told me was that money needed to be raised for travel expenses for elders to come to a certain place. Anyway, it just said that we need to raise a lot of money for travel expenses for these elders to meet and literally save the planet. And I was told, you know, that more information would follow. And then I met Jimmy. So, there's something really special going on. And now I guess we got away from the main subject. Did you want to get back to House of Joseph?
Do we have any calls?
Yeah, callers. We're still looking for some callers. If you'd like to call in, USA 877-876-5227. If you have any interest in the House of Joseph or learning how to become a Joe, or if you're in Canada or the U.S., you can call 888-815-9756. And we've got a little less than 7 minutes to go. I'd love to have you call in. I don't know if we're going to get any callers or not, but what's Creator telling you to say right now?
Well, I would like to point your listeners to the Jerusalem Connection to the Red Spirit. There's a very ancient Apache prayer which mentions the holy city of Jerusalem. Its translation, by the way, this was translated by Jay Lone Wolf, the man you mentioned at the top of the show who's in need of our prayers.
Right at the top of our BBS website.
Right. I spoke with him briefly this week. He's improving, but he still is not out of the woods. But he sent this this prayer for us to begin praying in the sweat lodges here. I'm just going to give you the translation, but it goes, I dance inside a circle of men and women, they say. Long life inside a circle is made, they say. Inside our circle dances the great spirit among us, they say. Having to prepare, he walks. Friends, they say, he walks back to Jerusalem, where the first tribe call home. And there's also this Hopi connection with Jerusalem, not just with the story I related from the Book of Mormon about Lehi ben Menashe ben Yosef and his son, but Chief Mike of the Hopi, who's been deceased now for about 10 years, but just before he rode away on his great white horse, he called a meeting of his people on Third Mesa at Old Arabi, Arizona, and together with Hotavia on the Third Mesa. And these are the oldest continually occupied places in North America. But he told his people that it was time to reveal a great secret that had been told to him by his grandfather just before the great white horse came for his grandfather years earlier. He was saddened by his grandfather's spirit beginning to fade and the horse neighing outside of his door. So his grandfather, to lift his spirit, told him that someday he would be chief. And when the time came for him to ride away, he would reveal this secret, that Tawanasavi, the place the Hopi call their origin, and which is literally translated in the Book of Hopi, the, quote, center of the universe, was Jerusalem. Now, when I studied at the Orthodox yeshivas in Jerusalem, specifically the yeshiva Or Samea, there was a teacher there who taught on the mystical concept of the center of the universe, and that being Jerusalem because of what is known as the Eben Shakia, the foundation stone upon which the retaining wall of the Temple Mount was built, is there in Jerusalem. And it's a stone so large that no human hand could have touched it, and therefore it's believed to be the center of the universe. Now, when I was told that story by a Cherokee woman who knocked on my door one day, totally out of the blue, shortly after I'd returned from Jerusalem, I found it hard to believe. I had to go down and make a personal visit to Hopi land. And during that first visit, I spoke with the late chief's three daughters and one of their husbands, Jimmy Ten Rivers, and I returned about 18 months later to seek the blessing of Medicine Man up on Third Mesa, and he confirmed Chief Mike's pronouncement. We also spoke with two Hopi at a campground near the Visitor Center on Second Mesa and a lady who operates the museum and gift shop. Again, confirmation. The Hopi have appointed a delegation to go to Jerusalem. They're ready to go and to take with them very ancient pottery shards, but, of course, they have to await an invitation.
Wow. So that, you know, that really makes it official. You know, it wasn't just Chief Mike that declared that. It was his father, Mike Lanza, and his father, John Lanza.
Right.
So, well, excuse me, his father, you know, his father, he was Chief Mike, and his mother, Mina, and before that, old John Lanza. And, of course, this does tie in with our mutual teacher, John Red Hat. And, oh, by the way, there's links from our BBS website to a lot of interesting places, including information about John Red Hat. And we've got about a minute and a half to go for the end of the show. If you want to offer some parting words, and folks, I want to remind you, please support Ben Yosef. Maybe one of the most important things that you'll ever do. But anyway, what have you got for us in the last minute and a half?
Well, I do appreciate the the opportunity to talk on your show tonight, Blue Otter. And we do have some very severe financial needs here. We're attempting to renovate a house that was purchased as a HUD repo. It's been vacant for several years. We were able to buy it, and now we're in the process of fixing it up so that these elders can start coming and have a place to stay and not have to worry about lodging and food while they're here. And we want to arrange it so they can stay for up to 20 days to attend our purification lodges, get to know the leaders in the community. We'll arrange transportation for them, everything. But this is going to cost us some money. And we are a very poor people. We have some severe needs. The city here, the town, I should say, has not been very nice to us. They've just increased our the charge to turn your utilities back on to $75 and have imposed a policy that you no longer have a month's leeway, but you, if you're delinquent 3 days on your utility bills, you're cut off.
Oh, my gosh. Folks, got about 5 seconds to go. I'll wake up Don and tell him to kick off our tag music. Thanks for listening to Prophecy Keepers for this week. We'll get together next week. Thank you so much, folks, and bye.
You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio.
You are listening to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine men of the Americas, the holy people of Africa, or the present-day Ottawahees of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times. From the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Levant, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Of others. Utah with us last week, and we had visits with Grandfather Red Elk had a seminar here, and you did a little bit of traveling with some other elders, and why don't you bring us up to date?
I'm sorry, my refrigerator just clicked on, so let me walk into the next room.
Okay. Anyway, Ben Yozef was with us last week, and we had interesting, we had about 100 people attend a seminar with Grandfather Red Elk in Fairview, Utah, and Ben Yozef was asked to speak there and stirred up some hearts. It was kind of interesting. Back with us yet, Ben Yozef?
Yep, here. Well, let's see. First of all, I want to thank you again, Lou Otter, for allowing me to be on your program. It's a real honor, and I also want to thank you for allowing me to be a special messenger for this White Roots of Peace Council.
Absolutely.
I think there is a message, and it's a special message, so I guess what I have to say kind of fits with, you know, the authority that you've given me to speak it. But I just got back from Utah and Wyoming yesterday, actually. So I'm a little bit sleep deprived, but I think I'm fresh enough now to talk about a few things.
Well, we can only hope. I know what I felt like after, oh my gosh, after two, I don't know, how long were those days? We sat with Red out from about 9 to 5, and after 2 days of that, my gosh, I was exhausted. Then we had another 2 nights of meeting. Go ahead.
Yeah. Actually, I after sitting under Red Elk's teaching for 2 days, my spirit was just lifted up. I just felt like I had received a needed revival of my spirit. That man is one of the most spiritual Native Americans who I've ever encountered, and I learned a whole lot from him. And I would encourage anyone who ever gets a chance to listen to Red Elk to make an opportunity to do it. I think the spirit was mighty in those meetings, and the one thing that I came away with the impression I came away with was that it is time for the judgment among all of us to end. There's only one person who's entitled to judge, and that's our Creator. And this judgmental spirit has got to go. And Red Elk, by the Spirit, moved in that direction, and conviction came upon so many people. And I have heard such wonderful things about, you know, that meeting that they needed to hear exactly what he told us. And it was awesome.
Yeah, I've been working with him since about 2003. And he gets after me. He'll get after you any kind of divisiveness. He'll just say, no, you're not going to go there. You got to focus. He focuses people. He brings you back.
Exactly.
But I was still my spirit was soaring, but I was tired. But, oh, my gosh. And then then the next couple nights, you know, we were in meetings over here with some wonderful folks. And go ahead, didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, I just really did enjoy the opportunity to share at his meeting. I felt like I had something kind of important to share, and so we talked, and he invited me to come out there, and I thought it was very, very well received. And that's kind of where I wanted to start this off tonight, is with what I talked about at that meeting. And that was simply that there's a move afoot that Native American sovereignty is being restored in this land. And I think the best signal of that is the end of 2,730 years of judgment that was decreed against the assimilated northern tribes of Israel, known as the House of Israel. As you know, Blue Otter, but maybe some of the people who are listening aren't aware of this, but Israel was divided into two families. There was the House of Israel, which was never Jewish, and then there's the House of Judah, which comprises the Jewish element of Israel. And these northern tribes were exiled 136 years before the southern tribes were exiled. And there had been a civil war. The city of Beth Shemesh in the territory of Judah was attacked by the northern tribes of Israel. One of the walls of Jerusalem was torn down by the northern tribes of Israel. And the northern tribes of Israel formed an alliance with the enemies of the southern tribes of Judah. And this was, you know, brothers against brothers, and it's unreconciled enmity and vexation, which the Bible addresses and says that enmity and vexation will be reconciled. And I believe we're coming right up on that time in history when this reconciliation is about to take place.
Let me interrupt you for just a second. We don't often toot our own horn, but there's a lot of folks out there, a lot of Cherokees, that just laugh, you know, when you assert that that we have some relationship with Israel. But let me explain. First, let me explain who I am, who Ben Yosef is, and what the Ketua Society elders say is the truth.
Okay, I'll just look.
Okay.
If you don't mind, I'll go pop me open a cold drink while you're talking.
Sure, this will take a couple of minutes, but we need to establish spiritual authority here and do it boldly. Okay, I speak for the White Roots of Peace Council. My traditional native name is Jasaya, which means otter, blue man, blue otter, if you will. I descend directly from Uka Ula, Savaduka. who was the war chief and speaker for the Cherokee Nation of circa 1775. He was the heir to the seat of the Cherokee Nation. He was the nephew of Okanastota, who was the headman of the Cherokee Nation. Now, you come down to this day, the original Kituwa Society in 1949 held sovereignty for the entire Cherokee Nation, which was disbanded by Congress in 1906. The Kituwa Society, well, there were Christianized elements that applied for and received federal recognition, but the Kituwa Society, and particularly one clan, the Longhair Clan, for which my traditional teacher, John Red Hat, was a member. And John Red Hat was recognized by the last three chiefs at Oribe as the true white brother because of his special qualifications. And you can read about that at redhat-speak.com. But John was a very special man. And John gave me put me on the trail of a video which was produced in 1984 by Bill Jones, who was a news commentator for KJRH-TV in Tulsa. A video was produced, about 55 minutes long, and you can listen to it at KituwaSociety.org, KeetoowahSociety.org. And in that society, in that video, for the first time, Chief William Smith publicly displayed the Cherokee wampum belts. And they had a board with Cherokee syllabary that was written in the hand of Sequoia. And he says that in there. He says that means we are Israel. He mispronounced it the first time. He says we're Israel. And he says, we are Israel Salmers. So then you also had the chief of the Northern Cherokee Nation who wrote a book around the subject, partially around the subject. The book was called We Are Not Yet Conquered. And anyway, that's who we are. Well, some people laugh at us, but we have a former member of the Revived Sanhedrin, Rabbi Mikhail Bar-Ron, who's writing, he was a little skeptical of this a couple, 3 years ago when I interviewed him, but he's writing a book about this subject now. So are you back with us, Ben Yosef?
Yeah, I'm here.
So that's who we are. And I come down from Wolf Clan people. A lot of Cherokees just think there's seven clans, but they're actually more in recent history. There's 14. Before that, there was over 80, and one of them was the Fire Clan. And I'll let Ben Yosef take it from there.
Well, just to underline what you said, Blue Otter, there are numerous evidences of links between the Cherokee, especially, and the Hebrew priesthood. The most obvious one to me is a book that was written in the 1700s by a man named James Adair. It was called The History of the American Indian. Adair was a Scotsman, and he lived among the Cherokee for more than 30 years before he wrote this book. And he found 23 similarities in the culture, the customs, and the writings of the Cherokee that lined up with priestly traditions that are spelled out in the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, also called the Law of Moses. One of the most profound of these is the fact that Cherokee, North Carolina, where there's to this day a sacred mound upon which at one time there was some type of a council house that was built, but it's a very sacred area today. But this mound at Cherokee, North Carolina, today is considered a city of refuge. And if anyone is aware of the concept of the city of refuge in the Bible, you know, that's whenever someone is killed and death is determined to be an accidental death by the council, then so long as the individual who was involved with the death of an individual stays in a protected city of refuge, he is safe. But if he leaves the city, then he's at the mercy of what is known as the Avenger of Blood, usually a close relative of the person who was killed. Of course, this doesn't apply if it's a murder or if there's any premeditation at all, only if it's an accidental death. And that exactly conforms to what the Torah says about the city of refuge. And again, there are 22 other priestly similarities, but also I've discovered from since coming back from Israel in 2001 and making many friends among the Native Americans in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico in the Four Corners area, that there are also priestly ties in this area. There was a survey that was done which determined that the extra Y chromosome, which is characteristic of those people who are direct descendants of Aaron, the brother of Moses, in other words, from the priestly line of Israel, they have this haplography called an extra Y chromosome, and it's characteristic only of descendants of Aaron. And that extra Y chromosome shows up here in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico more than 30 times greater than in any other known population sample anywhere in the world. Now let me try to explain what this means. In the last days, we're told that there is going to be a priesthood that's known as the priesthood of the Zadokites. And this priesthood is supposed to decide in all matters of controversy. They're also supposed to teach the difference between what is clean and unclean and what is holy and what is common, which is exactly what Moses was charged to do with the children of Israel. I'm hearing an awful lot of popping on the line. Are we getting through okay?
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
There is a growing movement of people who are deciding to make their lives better. At LifeVantage, we're in the business of change, of improving quality of life globally and restoring the ability to make dreams a reality. Your quest for personal fulfillment begins here. Our flagship product, Protandem, the Nrf2 Synergizer, is the key to fighting oxidative stress. This daily supplement, comprised of natural ingredients, activates the body's antioxidant enzymes to eliminate free radicals, which cause oxidative stress. Protandem has been tested in the laboratories of renowned universities such as The Ohio State University, LSU, and the University of Colorado, Denver. These studies found on PubMed.gov, the U.S. government's online scientific library, clinically show that Protandem reduces oxidative stress.
When I saw that Protandem reduces oxidative stress by 40% in 30 days, I was all in for the rest of my life.
Everyone begs us for science as an industry. Where's your proof? Well, we have that also.
LifeVantage is devoted to advancing Nrf2 science and leading the fight against oxidative stress.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Anyway, became pretty much apparent that there is some kind of a tie between the Native American population and the Hebrews. And you see evidences of it all over this country. Anyone who's traveled to Mississippi Mountain there in New Mexico can find a stone that is engraved with the Ten Commandments in Paleo Hebrew. And it dates to the time before the Common Era. So, you know, we're talking about very ancient things, and there's many other evidences as well. But I guess the one thing I had wanted to talk with your listeners about tonight that kind of relates to this tangentially is, you know, this move toward the, I would say, the spiritual sovereignty being restored to the Native people. And this happens at the end of 2,730 years of judgment against the house of Israel known as Ephraim. Now, the way this is all determined, Blue Otter, was there was a judgment that was decreed against both the northern tribes of Israel and the southern tribes of Israel. It happened when the prophet Ezekiel was told to lay on his side facing the north a number of days, and then lay on his side facing the south a number of days.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, friends. This is Blue Water. Ayurvedic medicine is also called Ayurveda. It's a system of medicine that originated in India several thousand years ago. The term Ayurveda combines two Sanskrit words, Ayur, which means life, and Veda, which means science or knowledge. Ayurveda means the science of life. Ayurveda is a whole medical system which integrates and balances the body, mind, and spirit. Thus, it's considered holistic. This balance is necessary for contentment and good health. While pharmaceutical companies extract active ingredients from plants and sell them as drugs, the benefits of medicinal plants cannot be replicated because their synergistic combination of hundreds of naturally occurring phytochemicals cannot be reproduced in laboratories. This fact has been known to Ayurveda for thousands of years. The benefit comes from using the whole plant, not just the isolated ingredient. Because they contain whole herbs and fruits, Ayurvedic formulas are safer and more effective as opposed to Western formulations, which oftentimes have harmful side effects. We satisfy the health needs of our customers through safe, well-researched, and effective Ayurveda-based remedies using premier quality herbal extracts and sound manufacturing practices. We believe in Ayurveda so much, we're willing to offer you a 110% money-back guarantee. So be sure and visit india-herbs.us today and find out what this is all about.
Hi, folks, we're back. We're having some bandwidth problems. I'm on Skype. Ben Joseph's on a VOIP, Voice Over Internet Protocol. So anyway, we're back. We were talking about spiritual sovereignty. Take it away, Ben Joseph.
Okay, well, thank you again, Blue Otter. And again, I apologize to anyone who's heard all this popping on the line.
Should be all right.
But anyway, I was saying that the prophet Ezekiel was told to lay on his side facing north and lay on his side facing south, and the number of days that he lay on his side in each direction would be decreed as 1 year of judgment against each house of Israel. And he lay on his side facing the north 390 days, which meant there was a decree of judgment of 390 years. Well, that length of time came and went, and the house of Israel did not repent of its transgression. The house of Judah did repent within the number of years they were allocated, and they were returned to the land. Of course, the temple was rebuilt, and you had the scenario for when Jesus arrived, which is recorded in the New Testament. But what about the house of Israel? What happened to them? Well, the 390 years came and went. They did not repent, and in the Torah, again, the first five books of the Bible, or the Law of Moses, as it's called, there's a ruling that if a judgment is decreed, and of course the decree came by Ezekiel acting out his sentence, but if a judgment is decreed and the people do not repent within the time of that decree, then the judgment itself is multiplied times seven, which means that 390 years now becomes 2,730 years. And reckoned from the time of the exile of the northern tribes of Israel in 722 before the Common Era, that judgment of 2,730 years expired on October 10th, 2008. And with the expiration of that judgment, then Ephraim, the northern tribes of Israel, is now my people again. In other words, the judgments that cut the northern tribes of Israel out of the covenant with the God of Israel were that God would scatter them, he would remove his mercy from them, and he would declare, "You're not my people, I'm not your God." In other words, he was finished with the house of Israel. The God of Israel was finished with the northern house of Israel, but not with the southern house of Judah. They've remained in his covenant. Not so the northern tribes of Israel. Now, The northern tribes of Israel, however, since this decree has now ended, are in the same boat. Their salvation, if you will, I don't really like that word salvation because I think it has a lot of connotations that go into theological concepts, which, you know, we're not really dealing with here. We're just dealing with the attitude that God has toward the northern tribes of the house of Israel and his plans for the northern tribes of the house of Israel.
Let me interrupt you for just a second.
Until now. Sorry.
Folks, if you're listening out there, and I guess, Ben Yosef, wouldn't you agree there's probably about a 90% chance that if they're listening, that they are, this applies to the people that are listening. They probably don't realize it. Is that correct?
Well, that's what I prayed before you called, was that this word would go out to those who are supposed to hear it and who have the ears to hear it. And, you know, if anyone has questions they'd like to ask us, I sure hope they'll call in and we get a chance to talk with someone. But all I'm saying is that now that the judgment of Ephraim has ended, that means that Ephraim can assume this all-important birthright, which was assigned to Ephraim. At the same time that this renewed covenant is supposed to be made with the house of Israel, Ephraim is called God's firstborn. That's in Jeremiah chapter 31, for those who want to look it up. If Ephraim is God's firstborn, you know what? Blue Otter, they got to start acting like God's firstborn.
That's right. And, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about the scriptures because of bad translations. And there's a scripture that says that the scepter will remain between the feet of Judah until people pronounce it Shiloh, but it's Shiloh. And most people, when they read that, they think in their mind, oh, that must mean Jesus. Tell them what it means, Ben Yosef.
Well, Shiloh is just a city in Jerusalem, and it's the place where Jeroboam, who was the first king of the northern tribes of Israel, was received his coronation at, in the city of Shiloh. And
in Encyclopedia Judaica says it means city of Ephraim, and it was the place
where
the ark and the tabernacle resided for about 160 years.
I'm not up on the total number of years it was there, but it's true that the Ark of the Covenant was at Shiloh for some time, and it obviously was a city that figured prominently in the northern kingdom of Israel later, and the fact that Jeroboam was coronated there could have indicated at that time, you know, said that that scepter would not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but the other thing I get, and I don't want to underline, is that the Ephraim's got some different meanings here. And when we're talking about Ephraim, we're not just talking about Ephraim. We're talking about sometimes we're specifically referring to Ephraim, but sometimes you can say Ephraim and refer to all the tribes that were part of the northern kingdom. So now I'll shut up.
That's true. The northern house of Israel often has the generic name Ephraim. And you see a reference to this in Ezekiel chapter 37, where there's a reference to two sticks that will eventually rejoin together. One is called for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and the house of Israel together with him. And the other one is the stick of Judah and the children of Israel together with him. So you can see in both of them include part of Israel. The house of Israel, which biblically and historically defines the entirety of the northern tribes, however, goes under the stick of Joseph Ephraim. And for that reason, Ephraim is sometimes used generically to represent all of the house of Israel. Hello?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Keep talking.
Oh, keep talking. Okay. Sorry. Anyway, now that this period of judgment is over, and Ephraim should be ready to assume this birthright responsibility, the question is, what should they do? And the Spirit is telling me, if I'm hearing the Spirit correctly, the Spirit is telling me that Ephraim must reach out to his brothers. And his brothers, of course, are Manasseh, who is the other son of Joseph, and the older son of Joseph, biblically, and Benjamin. And Benjamin is part of this family of Joseph, because whenever there was a divining cup of Joseph found in Benjamin's sack, a decree was made by all of Benjamin's brothers. They said they were so confident that the head of Joseph's household would never find the divining cup in any of their sacks that they said, if that cup is found in anybody's sack, the person in whose sack it's found will die, and the rest of us will be your servants. They were so confident. So the head of Joseph's household said, it will be as you say. So in some manner, Benjamin had to die, and they would have to be servants to Joseph. But then the head of Joseph's household went on to say that the one in whose sack the cup was found would become the servant to his master, and the rest of them would be exonerated. But the death came about because Benjamin then became part of the family of Joseph and was removed from this other status with the rest of the brothers of Israel. And the idea of sovereignty is expressed even here with the rest of the tribes of Israel somehow paying homage to this house of Joseph. Now, it's kind of interesting to me that the house of Joseph is like the monarchy of the northern tribes of Israel in the same way that the house of Judah was the monarchy, I'm sorry, the house of David was the monarchy for the southern tribes of Judah. And there are all kinds of things written in the oral traditions of the Jewish people that whenever this reunion takes place between the children of Joseph and the children of Judah, it will be as though even the angels in heaven would shut their mouths and watch what was going on, because there would be two kings that would be approaching one another.
And actually, people don't realize there's actually supposed to be two messiahs, Messiah ben Yosef and Messiah ben David, and this debate was going on at the time of Jesus.
Boy, you're going to open a can of worms there.
Well, okay, go ahead.
You're right. There will be two messiahs to appear in the last days. The first messiah, now I'm speaking here in terms of eschatology, or an understanding of end times events, not from the perspective of what Christians believe, or even what Native Americans believe, but what is taught in the Orthodox yeshivas in Jerusalem. And in the Orthodox yeshivas in Jerusalem, we're told and taught that there will be two messiahs. The first will be the Messiah, the son of Joseph. Now, also we have to realize that when we use the word Messiah, we're not using it in a any kind of a title. We're using it simply to mean someone who is anointed. The word Messiah means anointed one. So the question is, what is this Messiah, son of Joseph, anointed to do? And what is this Messiah, son of David, anointed to do? Well, if you believe, as I do, that Jesus was the Messiah, the son of David, who first came in order to bring this assimilation of the northern tribes of Israel back into covenant, and by the way, that does seem to be the purpose for his first coming, as expressed in the prophecies about him before his birth and at his infancy. You can read these in Luke chapter 1 and Luke chapter 2. And they will specifically address the rectification of the judgments that cut Israel off of the covenant. And those are found in Hosea chapter 1. Remember, Hosea was told to marry this harlot. Her name was Gomer. Well, that's where the northern tribes of Israel went whenever they were exiled. They went to the land of Gomer, which was in Assyria. And then from there, they crossed over into Europe, and they settled out throughout Europe, but primarily in the Scandinavian countries, the coast of Normandy, crossed the British Channel into Scotland, went down to Ireland, went down to Wales and crossed over to Ireland. So through European, not just British colonization, but through European colonization, every nation of the world has the seed of these people who were exiled in Assyria. And it's kind of technical, and if people would like to look at this on my website, they can get more information. That website is www.torah, T-O-R-A-H, hyphen, voice, V-O-I-C-E, .org. And there's many articles on there that will explain this concept in more detail. But I only mention it now to indicate that the mission of Jesus as this Messiah, son of David, was simply to renew this covenant. In his own words, he said in Matthew chapter 15, "I am sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Now, biblically and historically, that house of Israel is the northern tribes of Israel.
Right.
Theologically, the church has tried to make the lost sheep of the house of Israel unsaved Jews, in their opinion, which is, in my mind, a judgment of the church against the Jewish people, which is not a proper judgment. But that's another topic. But anyway, Jesus came the first time as this Messiah, son of David, promising that he would come again. When naturally he has to wait for this gospel of the restoration of the kingdom to Israel to make its way into all of the nations before the end can come. And he told his disciples whenever they asked him, "Master, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" He couldn't tell them when because that wasn't in his authority. He said it's in the authority of the Father alone. But he told them how. He said when the Holy Spirit would come upon them, that they would be his witnesses to this restoration of the kingdom to Israel. First in Jerusalem, then Judea, Samaria, then the uttermost parts of the earth. Now, it's interesting to me that he specifically mentioned Judea, Samaria, Blue Otter, because today, when you mention Judea, Samaria, you're referring to the West Bank, which the Palestinians are wanting as their state. But Judea, of course, calls to mind the house of Judah, and Samaria calls to mind the house of Israel, because when the house of Israel was exiled, it was repopulated by Samaritans who were brought there by the Assyrians who exiled the house of Israel. So when you see that phrase Judea, Samaria used in any context, you have to think of it in terms of the ancient homeland of the house of Judah and the house of Israel. And if God is after a reconciliation between these two families, in other words, if his intent is to bring them back to their historic inheritances, which is indicated in Hosea chapter 2, he goes on to say, although he's removed his mercy from them, although he's declared them not his people, although he's scattered them into all the nations, he says that they will be so numerous they will outnumber the sand on the seashore. And in the same place where it was told them, "You're not my people," there, in the land of Israel, they will be called sons of the living God. So this demands a return, at least by a remnant, of this house of Joseph.
Wow, nonstop energy. Well, I cannot even imagine. And just for example, last night, you did a show last night that was 90 minutes starting at 7:30.
That's right.
Then you went through that. Then you came here. You're here this morning.
That's right.
Doing all of this.
It's nonstop. I don't sleep anymore.
No. All right. So where do you get the energy? Seriously. I mean, look at you.
Well,
I mean, we've known each other a long time. Yeah. We've passed. You don't ever get older.
Well, thank you. It's quite funny because, you know, people are kind of shocked when they hear that I'm 54 years old. And they say, how do you keep your youth? I have found something, Dr. Phil, that I think is the closest thing to the fountain of youth.
Oh, you do have a secret.
I have a secret, and I've never really talked about it. Well, I've been doing this for the last 2 years. It's called Protandem, and it works. And I'm telling everybody about this.
You feel differently.
I do.
Because you're running around like a chicken with your head cut off.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're hitting the times. You're getting where you're supposed to be.
I have
to
be on the spot all the time.
Now, I've got three sisters. And we get along great, 1,500 miles apart. I cannot imagine.
It takes me 1,600 miles.
Yeah, but I can't imagine working with my sister every day. What do you do when you have disagreements? Because you have to have disagreements, right? Because
well,
you're both producers.
Yeah, we're both producers, and that's difficult because we're both type A. And you're going to butt heads. What's really interesting about the Donnie Marie duo is that it doesn't really matter how much we butt the heads when that curtain goes.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
And my personal interest in this, of course, relates to Native American sovereignty and the many evidences that Native Americans have these roots of the house of Joseph. One of the strongest indicators is the writings in what I call the diary of Nephi. Nephi, the son of Lehi ben Menashe ben Yosef.
For all your Mormons out there, we're talking about Nephi and Lehi.
Oh, I apologize.
That's okay.
I have to use the Hebrew pronunciations because it's much easier for me. But,
right. Well, let me interject a point here. You know,
sure.
From what I've read of Jewish prophecy, it was a longstanding prophecy that at some time among the Gentiles, a group of people would stand up and claim to be Ephraim. And to my knowledge, Mormons are the first people to do this. So go ahead.
Well, actually, there are probably 2.5 million people in the world today who know that they are part of this Joseph Ephraim. And this revelation came to me in two ways. The first was in 1998 through a dream in which I counted sheep all night. And, I mean, you've seen these cartoons where someone's sleeping beside a tree stump and the sheep jump over and they're counting sheep at a time. Well, this isn't the way it happened, Blue Otter. There were droves of sheep, and they were running and jumping over something like a ditch. And as they would jump over, I instinctively, in the dream, I would never be able to do this while awake, but in the dream, I instinctively knew the number of sheep in each drove that came by. And I counted these things all night long, and when I woke up, the total was 2,520,760. Now, we cannot number the house of Israel, but we may be able to number the house of Joseph that will make their return. And another question has to be asked, why would the house of Joseph want to return to that land with all the violence and the trouble over there? Well, one possible answer is we're a solution to it, especially the Native Americans who would comprise what is known as the descendants of Laman ben Lehi ben Menashe ben Yosef, or who the Book of Mormon refers to as the oldest son of Lehi. Sorry,
the Lamanites. That's what the Mormons
right.
call them.
The Lamanites, because there's an ancient prophecy in the Book of Mormon that whenever Lehi came to this river in Egypt, this is before they made their way over to the Americas. But he came to this river in Egypt, and he was pretty disappointed with his son, Laman. And so he prophesied when he saw this river that was empty, but then the Red Sea would come in with the tide and fill it up, and then, of course, it would go back out. And then, the tide would come in, and it would fill up again, and then it would go out again, and then the tide would come back in and fill up, and then it would go out again, and then back in, and then back out. The reason I said that four times, it's because the Hopi prophecies indicate that the Hopi were to make four migrations to each of the four directions, but each time returning to the place from which they sent. In the same way, Lehi prophesied to his son Laman that he should be like that river continually returning to the source of all righteousness. So that's one of many links that I have found in my research of the Book of Hopi, which was published in 1976 by Dr. Frank Waters, and in the Book of Mormon, which I'm really just getting into. I think I'm on my third read now, but I'm far from an expert on this book, and I've tried to stay out of the doctrine altogether. I'm interested only in the historicity of it.
So you're saying the Book of Mormon didn't have the same effect on you that it did on Mark Twain?
Well, I'm not sure what.
Did you ever hear that joke?
Mark Twain.
He said that if you ever had problems with insomnia, all he had to do was read the Book of Mormon.
No, it's kept me awake many nights, as a matter of fact. I really enjoyed reading it. And I believe there's a lot of truth contained in it. But I also believe that, just like it tells us in the Book of Revelation, that the spirit of the prophet is subject to that prophet. And if Joseph Smith was a prophet, you know, I'm certain that a lot of the things in the Book of Mormon are true, and I'll not take issue with them. But I'm also certain that as a prophet, a lot of his revelations are subject to his own spirit.
And he said that. He said that if the Book of Mormon had any errors, they're errors of men. And he also said that
And Brigham Young also reiterated what Joseph said, that if the people deserve to be led astray, they'd be led astray. So I'll let you continue.
There's some proof to that. It's like what we sow is what we reap. Which brings me to another topic, which is tangentially related to the return of sovereignty in this land. There was an attempt made during the summer of 2007 by the Nimbrino Apache community in southern Colorado to secure the return of the skull of Geronimo. We felt that after 400 years that it might be the time to make this appeal. It was made by a direct descendant of Geronimo, in fact, his greatest granddaughter. Her name is Ada Fast Horse. And Ada had asked that someone take a message to Washington, D.C. and deliver it to the White House because President George W. Bush was a member of this Skull and Bone Society along with his father, President George H.W. Bush, and the Skull and Bone Society uses the skull of Geronimo in these very unclean rituals that go on there at Yale University. If anyone will take the time to research the history, you'll find that a man by the name of Prescott Bush, the grandfather to President George W. Bush and the father to President George H.W. Bush, led a raiding party to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where they dug up Geronimo and a few other young Apaches. They took their skulls and femur bones to Yale University, where they have this unclean ritual in which vows are made to Satan, and they're given these secret names. The thing that is alarming to me, and this brings it right back to Israel again, is that the secret name that was taken by George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush was the name Gog, which we would spell, or you may pronounce it Gog, which would be spelled G-O-G in English.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Developed after 40 years of research and exclusively for LifeVantage, Protandem is a true scientific breakthrough in anti-aging. Protandem has been reported on ABC, NBC, and PBS, featured in the Wall Street Journal, and described in CNN Chief Medical Correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta's book, Chasing Life, The Quest for Immortality. Protandem's creator, Dr. Joe McCord, is a world-renowned scientist and a pioneer in free radical biology. Dr. McCord is the discoverer of the key anti-aging enzyme, superoxide dismutase. His role in the discovery is so significant, the enzyme is measured in McCord units.
So it's very exciting, and it's really quite an honor at this time to be working with a doctor like Dr. McCord. You know, the information that he has put out is published in some of the most well-respected, scrutinized, peer-reviewed literature, like, for example, Free Radical Biology and Medicine, an incredibly powerful journal. But these articles and these studies that he has published really make it clear that this is very, very powerful chemistry.
For Dr. McCord's discovery of superoxide dismutase and his contributions in free radical biology, he was awarded the Elliott Cresson Medal. This medal is awarded to distinguished inventors and scientists, putting Dr. McCord in the same company as Pierre and Marie Curie, Alexander Graham Bell, Orville Wright, and Henry Ford. Dr. Joe McCord has devoted his life's work to the study of free radicals, their role in aging, and the many problems associated with aging.
Our bodies are producing hundreds of millions of free radicals at any given time. And the notion that we're going to put out that fire or quench that number of free radicals with a single capsule of, for example, vitamin E or vitamin C, really, when you think about it, doesn't make much sense. Rather, the approach is to turn on the genes to make huge numbers of copies of antioxidant chemicals in our body, things like catalase and superoxide dismutase and glutathione.
Consumers spend billions every year on antioxidants in the form of food and supplements, hoping to reduce these free radicals. But antioxidants from these sources can only eliminate one free radical for every one antioxidant molecule you consume. Protandim is scientifically proven to slow cellular damage caused by free radicals. Taking one Protandim one time per day for 30 days turns on these anti-aging enzymes in your body. Your own enzymes eliminate free radicals at a rate of 1 million to 1.
I think any other supplements that are designed to be antioxidant supplements probably are no longer needed, because Protandim solves that problem in a much more effective way.
Protandim is a breakthrough poised to revolutionize the anti-aging industry. It is an entirely new and scientifically validated way to fight aging, reducing your oxidative stress levels to that of a 20-year-old after just 30 days.
So the danger of these free radicals when they're produced as a normal part of our physiology is they induce what is called oxidative stress. And we can consider oxidative stress to be essentially rusting of the human body. And it's not just the parts, but we actually damage our DNA. The very genes that make us who we are to some degree are damaged by the process of oxidative stress, meaning that we can't heal properly and our bodies are more prone to aging. We found, as many other scientists had documented, that there is a progressive increase in T-bars in your blood the older you get. When these same people took Protandim for 30 days, the age-dependent increase in lipid peroxidation was completely eliminated. After Protandim, we could no longer distinguish the 80-year-old from the 20-year-old.
Protandim is protected by 3 U.S. patents. Universities around the world continue to initiate and fund their own studies of Protandim and to evaluate how this anti-aging breakthrough can prevent and improve many of the hundreds of problems associated with aging.
Many academic scientists at a number of universities have begun studying Protandim because it represents a new tool. It represents a way of reducing oxidative stress that wasn't available before. There simply was not a good way of doing what Protandim does. Protandim interacts with the DNA in your cells and causes the cells to make more of a set of genes called survival genes. The immediate benefits of Protandim are, within several days, the biochemical markers of oxidative stress begin to decrease. And while these are immediate improvements, you may not sense that these things are happening, just as you can't sense what your cholesterol level is, if it's high or low. But nonetheless, these benefits start happening within days of taking Protandim. The advantages to taking Protandim in the long term are that it protects your body from the relentless progression of free radical damage as we age. The anti-aging aspect of Protandim is one that accumulates over time, so the longer you take it, the more protection you will sustain. Missing a dose of Protandim is not a big problem. It takes about 2 weeks for the effects to go away. So if you miss it for 2 weeks, you're pretty much back to where you started from. Protandim doesn't interfere with other supplements. If you have a desire to supplement vitamins and minerals, you certainly can continue to do that. Most people in America get a diet that is vitamin replete, meaning you have all the vitamins you need. So vitamin supplementation is generally not required. We've got to have the hard science behind products that we recommend. And unfortunately, there are a lot of products out on the market today that do not have the science that they need. Protandim has the science that you can depend on.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
But here's the interesting part, Blue Otter. The name GOG is also an abbreviation for the name George, because in modern Hebrew, a native Israeli speaker has difficulty with the name George. The R sound coming after a long O just does not come out easily for native Israelis. Instead, George is pronounced Joj, as you would spell it J-O-J. However, in Hebrew, there is no J. So instead, you adopt the G sound, which is the Gimel. And so the name George would be spelled Gimel Vav Gimel, the exact way that you spell Gog. Now, if you take the rest of George W. Bush's name, which would be Gog Walker Bush, the gematria of that name is 666. Now, by gematria, I mean that every Hebrew letter in the alphabet is assigned a numerical value. The first 10 letters are assigned the number 1 through 10. Then the next 10 letters, 20 through 100, and in the final three, 200, 300, and 400. If you add up the totality of the name, Gog Walker Bush, it is 666, which means that this is an individual who will figure prominently and in a, let's say, a disreputable way into the affairs of the state of Israel. And we've seen this happen already with the demands by George H.W. Bush that the settlements, the Jewish settlements in the land of Judea Samaria, be abandoned and no new settlements built. This happened right after the Gulf War ended when George H.W. Bush was president. He sent James Baker to Israel with this demand. And in doing so, and by the way, this was simply to placate the Arab nations who had agreed not to align themselves with Saddam Hussein if the United States would force Israel to negotiate a Palestinian state in the territories of Judea Samaria. Here's the problem with that, Blue Otter. The land of Joseph, known as the birthright territories, are part of this Arab state, this Palestinian state that's being proposed and has been backed by our State Department. Why is this a problem? Well, in the little book of Obadiah, the smallest book in all the Bible, the little book of Obadiah, we're told that whenever the children of Jacob would start returning to their inheritances, they would find them occupied by the house of Esau. This means that biblically and historically, the house of Esau is today living in the territories of Joseph. And the State Department is wanting to make that a permanent arrangement, which means tampering with a birthright, which results in a curse. All Native American tribes know, and you know, Blue Otter, when you tamper with a birthright, that is the darkest of the black roads. And I'm just going to say that now that Native American sovereignty has been restored after 400 years, after the what I call the failed experiment called Manifest Destiny. Manifest Destiny was the declaration by these European settlers comprising the root stock, at least, of the children of Ephraim, whenever they came from European nations and from the British Isles, too. But when they came here, they declared that it was their destiny that this land would be theirs, without regard for the people who were here already, signing treaties with them and breaking every one of those treaties that ever had been signed. Now, the God of Israel is a God of his word, and he does not break his word. And therefore, I know and convinced that those treaties that were signed and broken on behalf of this Manifest Destiny experiment mark Manifest Destiny as an abject failure. And after 400 years of it, enough. After 400 years of it, just like Abraham waited 400 years for the sovereignty to return to him and his descendants, the sovereignty is returning to the native peoples. And this is reflected in the prophecies of the Hopi. The Hopi were told whenever the last of their clans returned, all of the places that they had staked out would be theirs. They would have the sovereignty. And now you're seeing these clans coming up from the south in massive, massive, massive droves. By the millions, you have the Hopi descendants returning from the south. And this means that the sovereignty of this land has changed hands. We're now a majority Hispanic people, and these Hispanics represent this seed of the assimilation of the Hopi with these people mentioned in the Book of Mormon as the Lamanites.
At this point, let me interject. Folks, if you don't see the parallel between the end of the 2,730 years as of early October and the largest financial collapse in history, the end of the American empire, everything has changed, the board is being swept, then you're just not getting it. Now, we've got about 5 minutes left, so go ahead and wrap up, and then I need a minute before.
Right. Let me just, again, reiterate what you said. Every aspect of American experience right now is laboring under a curse, and I believe that curse has come upon us because of the Bush presidencies. During the presidency of George H.W. Bush, we preferred Iraq over the territories of Joseph. Had we spent all those resources helping Israel develop the territories of Joseph, we would be blessed instead.
Oh, there's tons of oil under that territory.
That's right. The prophecies about Joseph and his blessing relate specifically to the blessing of the deep on the crown of the head of Joseph. And if you look at my website at www.torah-voice.org, you will see an outline of Judea Samaria that forms the head of a man wearing a crown. And right at the tip of that crown is Megiddo, or the area that is also known in Greek as Armageddon. And this is going to be massive tank farms, oil storage tanks. It's going to be energy related, and I believe this will be the spoil that the forces of Gog are going to invade Israel for. Ideologically, during the Bush administrations, our State Department has been this Gog, attacking Israel on every front ideologically. And unfortunately, ideological attacks over time tend to become reality.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Developed after 40 years of research and exclusively for LifeVantage, ProTandem is a true scientific breakthrough in anti-aging. ProTandem has been reported on ABC, NBC, and PBS, featured in the Wall Street Journal, and described in CNN Chief Medical Correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta's book, Chasing Life, The Quest for Immortality. ProTandem's creator, Dr. Joe McCord, is a world-renowned scientist and a pioneer in free radical biology. Dr. McCord is the discoverer of the key anti-aging enzyme, superoxide dismutase. His role in the discovery is so significant, the enzyme is measured in McCord units.
So it's very exciting, and it's really quite an honor at this time to be working with a doctor like Dr. McCord. You know, the information that he has put out is published in some of the most well-respected, scrutinized, peer-reviewed literature, like, for example, Free Radical Biology and Medicine, an incredibly powerful journal. But these articles and these studies that he has published really make it clear that this is very, very powerful chemistry.
For Dr. McCord's discovery of superoxide dismutase and his contributions in free radical biology, he was awarded the Elliott Cresson Medal. This medal is awarded to distinguished inventors and scientists, putting Dr. McCord in the same company as Pierre and Marie Curie, Alexander Graham Bell, Orville Wright, and Henry Ford. Dr. Joe McCord has devoted his life's work to the study of free radicals, their role in aging, and the many problems associated with aging.
Our bodies are producing hundreds of millions of free radicals at any given time. And the notion that we're going to put out that fire or quench that number of free radicals